Oh, it offends me to the soul to hear a robustious, periwig-painted fellow tear a passion to tatters, to very rags, to split the ears of the groundlings, who for the most part are capable of nothing but inexplicable dumb shows and noise.
Well, Henny, you better hang on to your bear bodkin, because you're going to hate this. It's John Malden, your host of the Inexplicable Dumb Show, starting now.
Hi, and welcome to episode 554 of the Inexplicable Dumb Show. I'm John Malden, and this week I am joined in Studio 1103 by director Santiago Sosa, who's directed Winter's Tale for this summer's Nashville Shakespeare Festival. So we're going to get into our conversation about Shakespeare and all things wintery? I don't know. Winter is coming. Now that's another show. Anyway, we're going to get into our discussion about Winter's Tale right after these brief messages. Would you like to be a pal of the Inexplicable Dumb Show? Why don't you head on over to www.inexplicabledumbshow.com and look for the Hosting Donations Accepted button. Press that and make a donation and help the Dumb Show cover its web hosting fees. Your donation is greatly appreciated. Thank you for your support.
Hi, I am someone you will probably never meet. Yet I ask you to take time
to think about people you don't know but need your help. Children, some of them. And they don't all play,
don't
in, the
all
gutter,
play
of course,
in the gutter, of course. Well, maybe if it's called for.
These men, women, and yes, even the children are professional actors. They want and need your time, money, and support.
For just pennies a second, you can enjoy the fruits of their labor. Make sure they know you heard about them on the Inexplicable Dumb Show. They may look at you funny, but that doesn't matter. It's for the children.
It's for the children.
It's time once again for some deep fried theater!
Alright, IDSers, I'm joined by Santiago Sosa, director of Winter's Tale for this summer's Nashville Shakespeare Festival. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the glorious Studio 1103.
Thank you. Glad to finally be here.
So, as we record this, you have just finished opening weekend, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so how did opening go?
Went great. We had a really good turnout. It rained out halfway through the second act yesterday, which is wont to do here in Nashville. But other than that, the turnout's been pretty great. Yeah. People seem to be really enjoying it.
Who gets to make the call on the rain out during a show?
That is definitely a stage manager call. So Teresa Driver, who's a great stage manager, she just has to monitor it. And if she sees it coming, she'll call the rain pace and they'll pick up the cues a little bit. And then if it starts to come, because it's all about breaking down the equipment also, so that nobody wants to do that in the rain or, you know, get electrocuted.
Right.
<It's> that.
That is a drawback.
Yeah. So they try and do it quickly once that rain starts coming.
So, now what's the mixture of your company? Do you have the apprentice company as well, or is that a completely different thing?
No, they're there too. So the apprentice company, I'm the apprentice company director, so I start off training them. And then I ran right into directing Winter's Tale, and we integrate the apprentices with the professionals, and they're actually in both shows. So the apprentices are both Antony and Cleopatra and the Winter's Tale with the pros.
So what entails in an apprentice company? Do they have like a Shakespeare boot camp for a couple of while? And then
actually, yeah.
Yeah.
We do call it boot camp. Those first 6 days, by the end of their first 6 days, they're pretty exhausted. It's a lot of vocal work. It's a lot of physical work. It's a lot of mental work. And they go anywhere from 6 to 8 hours of just voice, text, body. And it's physical, and we do a lot of athletic things, and they are pouring sweat, and then there's yoga, and my fiance Rachel comes in and does some yoga. She's like, "So we're going to do begin?" I was like, "Nope, we're going strong." And so she'll put them through some pretty intense yoga just to sort of get their bodies and minds in the zones of understanding that Shakespeare really requires, muscularity, not just in the tongue, the mouth, but the entire body. It's muscular text.
So would you say that is probably the area that the person kind of, I don't say that the apprentices are brand new to Shakespeare, but I mean, for purposes of our discussion, is that one of the area first to kind of develop versus text work and rhythm?
Absolutely. We don't really do any, you know, acting until we get their bodies ready. So until they understand that, to ground the text, they have to have a grounded body. So we talk a lot about bringing text from the earth through the legs and into the trunk. So just getting their legs strong, understanding that, you can speak with your entire body, not just your throat, and just unlocking different areas that they just had never really thought about. And once we sort of do that after the first 6-7 days, then we start chewing on words, making sounds. We spend a lot of times exploring on the mat, opening up the ribs, all that kind of thing. And I always say that it's not about what you're feeling, but it's about what you're saying. And you can't say anything unless you know how to chew on the words, you know how to ground the text physically.
Mm-hmm. So what then becomes... I'm sure they have, but have you been able to see kind of the light go on for them at this point in the process?
Absolutely. It's really incredible to see some people come in and struggle within the first couple days or first week with just working on some language to where they are now. It's unbelievable that we really look for people who are interested in working hard. We're not interested in finding people's like, oh, I've got it all figured out. We want right. people who, even if they do have it all figured out, maybe they want to take it to the next level. But I mean, who can really have it all figured out, you know, so to speak. But we look for people who are really interested in learning and collaborating right. and growing. And one of the reasons that I enjoy teaching, directing, and being an apprentice company director is I find more joy in watching other people get it, that light go off, than I do if there's 50,000 people applauding for my most amazing performance of all time. I get more joy out of that light going off for someone else than I do the other thing.
Right.
So it's always so rewarding, and I'm always sad once the training and directing part is over.
Someone comes out and puts a little towel around you and carries you back like Elvis.
Yeah, I'm always sad. I'm like, oh, the show's opening. Like, yay. They're like, the show's opening. And I'm like,
I'm done. That's
I got to go on to the next thing.
All right. So give us kind of the brief kind of Reader's Digest version of Winter's Tale.
Reader's Digest version.
So that most people are familiar, but just to remind us.
Well, it's a story about a king, and his best friend comes to visit him. His best friend's from Bohemia, comes to visit. And he's been there for about 9 months, and he realizes, hey, I've been here for way too long. I love being here in Sicily, but I gotta go. And the king says, well, why don't you stay a little bit longer? He said, I really need to get back to my son, take care of some business. He's like, come on, stay. He's like, I don't think I will. And then his wife, the queen, Hermione, he said, well, maybe you can get him to stay. And she does. She succeeds. And for whatever reason, something just turns and the king begins to realize, well, when I asked him, he wouldn't stay. But when you asked him, he did. And you're about 8-ish months pregnant. And he got here about 9 months ago. So he starts putting things together that aren't there. And he just lets it consume him. And he tells his right-hand man, Camillo, poison his cup, kill him, because he's sleeping with my wife, and that's not my kid, it's a bastard. And Camillo's like, oh, I don't think this is right. So he tells the king, Polixenes, he's trying to kill you, let's get out of here. So they hop on a boat, and they get out of here. And they go back to Bohemia. Puts his wife on trial, and he sends some people to Apollo, to his temple, to find out the truth. See what Apollo, the god, says. Let's leave it up to the gods. Mm-hmm. The gods come back. The oracles come back. And they said, well, Apollo said that she's blameless. She didn't do anything wrong. The kid is yours. And you are kind of a jerk. And it's coming straight, you know, from God.
From God's mouth to your ear. Right?
And he doesn't believe it. And he tears it up. And bad things happen, and his little child, who he thought was his bastard, he sends some other guy named Antigonus. He said, let's leave it up to chance. Take this baby, put it out on the shore somewhere, and let's see if some animals eat it, or if they take it for their own, or if somebody finds it. Let's just leave it up to chance. So he leaves it on the shores of Bohemia. And
thereby winning Father of the Year award.
Right. Yeah, he's not great, because then his wife dies and Apollo strikes his son dead, and he sent off his only heir to the throne to be eaten by wild animals. And the man Antigonus, who drops off the little girl, he has a dream, and Hermione says, let's call her Perdita. And so he puts her on the shore, and lo and behold, here comes the bear, and the bear eats him and tears him apart, so we can never find out whatever happened to the little girl.
It's horrible to laugh at, but
it's horrible. He gets ripped to shreds, and then the sailors also can't go back to Bohemia and tell anybody, because there's a storm, and their ships get sunk, and they all drown and die. It was a little dark at that point, but then it brightens up. And a clown and his dad show up, and then we fast forward 16 years, and the little girl, Perdita, has grown up, and she's a teenager, and she has actually fallen in love with the father, the king of Bohemia, Polixenes. She has fallen in love with his son, Florizel, and he's disguised himself so nobody really knows except for her. And then it turns into a bright comedy. And it's happy, and there's clowns, there's dancing, and there's love, and then there's a peddler and a con man, and somehow all of these crossroads eventually, when you go see it, reconnect. And so what started off as a very dark tragedy of, you know, having your children killed and throwing your wife in a prison cell. Well, there's some pretty heavy issues there. Bears killing men and sailors drowning. It gets better. It ends quite nice. There's a really nice, lovely fairy tale ending. So do remember that fairy tales are dark.
Right.
I mean, Little Mermaid, I think she turns into sea foam in the end. She loses in the real story.
Right, right.
This one ends a little bit happier.
That's a great director's note in the program at intermission. It gets better.
It does get better.
But that, like, so much like Shakespeare's text, though, it goes, ooh, you know, up and down and around.
Yeah.
So how do you, as the director, how do you keep the honesty and the, you know, whatever lifeness of the dark moments and balance that with the light moments and keep it kind of all in the same world?
It's hard. this one is hard. It's been an interesting journey. The last, I guess, 9 months I've directed, this is the third Shakespeare show. So I went from Romeo and Juliet to Two Gentlemen of Verona to this one. And the one thing that I keep saying is, like, let's play what's happening, the text. Let's not worry. Let's not play the melodrama. Let's not turn this into some big opera. Let's just play the truth of what's happening in the text. What's on the page is what we're going to put on the stage. And I say that even with the comedy. I said, the minute you guys start playing the comedy of the scene, people are going to stop laughing. So just play these moments honestly. And instead of attacking the text, just activate it. Mm-hmm. Let's see what comes out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done a great job. It's been a hard rehearsal process. This is one of Shakespeare's last plays that he wrote. And some people call it a romance. Some people call it a comedy. There's really no genre to define this one specifically.
Right.
Because it's a pastoral comedy. It's a kingdom comedy. It's got historical type things about it. It's a tragedy.
And there are bear maulings.
And yeah, there's bear maulings. There's a courtroom drama. There's everything. And so I said, because there are so many elements to this, and it's so hard to define this with one simple genre of theater, we just got to play each moment very honestly. And the language is so dense. I'm a big nerd for iambic pentameter and Shakespeare's metrical art. I've been spending the last 4 or 5 years really studying it. And this is complex. I mean, he'll jump in and out of prose and poetry to iambic pentameter to hexameter, and the meter is so complex that it really tells a lot about the characters. It's a doozy.
Is there any sort of concept laid on top of that?
There is, definitely. I grew up in South America. I lived in Ecuador almost my whole life. I'm from Texas, but my parents were missionaries, and I grew up in Ecuador. And the first time I had watched this play, it was about 9-10 years ago, and I really loved it. And then I started studying it. And for whatever reasons, I have to be able to, I'm a very visual person. I have to see what a character is when I read a Shakespeare play. Otherwise, I don't understand it. Mm-hmm. And if I can't see what they may or may not look like, I can't read it. And there's some Shakespeare plays that have taken me years to get through until I can really associate it with something. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I associated with was growing up in Ecuador, Simón Bolívar was the liberator of Great Colombia in the early 1800s. And he was a king. He was a very flawed man. He made a lot of mistakes, but he was a really phenomenal king, and people loved him, and he changed the face of South America forever. And so I always envisioned being inspired by that time in my life, because he was such a mythic figure. He was on currency and statues. We did plays about him, and we sang songs, and he was everywhere. And he in my mind was a king as a kid. I used to see that. So I thought, well, let's put it there. Let's give it that sort of lens. I try not to do anything too specific to history, because then there's rules, and I don't really like rules. So I always say it's inspired by, an imagined world inspired by this. Mm-hmm. And so you have two different worlds. So you have Sicilia, but then Bohemia is, and even Shakespeare didn't understand a whole lot of things, because he talks about taking a boat from Sicilia to Bohemia, and you can't get there by boat. They're landlocked. Like, Bohemia is landlocked. Mm. They didn't really understand geography too much. He just didn't pay care. And so I was like, well, if he doesn't concern himself with geography, then neither will I.
Right.
So I sort of set Bohemia into a mix between the jungles of South America and the Andes Mountains. So that sort of culture, which was very free country. It's this, the feel of it just felt like Bohemia to me, the colors. So I knew color was the most important thing. And when I think about the biggest bursts of color, it's in South America, Ecuador. There's just color everywhere. If you look at the city I used to live in, Guayaquil, it's just colorful blues and pinks and baby blues and yellows everywhere. And I knew that this play needed that color to tell the story correctly. And so there's a lot of deep purples in Sicilia. And then it's blinding how much color there is in Bohemia, the greens and the pinks. It's really lovely. So it is seen through the lens of someone that grew up in South America and traveled Ecuador, Colombia, Peru, Bolivia, Chile, Argentina. Because I like inventing my own worlds, and I try to keep things as personal as I can.
Okay.
Otherwise, you're just applying something because it's cool.
So, who are the members of your design team that had to come along? And
Trish is she works at MTSU. She used to work at the Rep. No, she still works at the Rep. She's great. These costumes are incredible. Trish Clark. And there's almost 30 people in this cast, something like 60, 70 costumes. And she's amazing. The stuff that she did was just beautiful. We have a guy named Charles who also sort of works around town, and he had done some work at the Rep, and he's built the set. And Natalie Bell, this is the third time I've collaborated with her. She did the music for me for Romeo and Juliet and for Two Gentlemen of Verona. And the music here is unbelievable. She did her homework, you can close your eyes. I can close my eyes and feel like I'm up in the Andes Mountains in Ecuador, up in Quito or something like that. She's great. There's Colleen's working on it, and there's props. It's a big design team, and it was a big show to take on, especially since we're doing a rotating Rep with Antony and Cleopatra.
Oh, so it is in Rep. Okay. I didn't
know. Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
So then not only that, right, because you're going to be in Centennial Park for a while, but is this one that's also going to Franklin, is it?
Correct.
Moving to Franklin?
They both are. So all 30 actors will be going over. They've been working hard. They got a day off today, and they deserve it. They've earned it.
Awesome. So how long is it in the Centennial Band Shell?
It's there for till September. I don't want to give you the raw. September 17th, I believe, is the that date, and then they get a week off.
A week off.
And then they'll be in Franklin until, let's see, let me look at here. Yeah, then they go into Franklin 28th through the 1st of October.
Right, so that kind of week and a half or whatever over there in Franklin. All right. Well, thank you, man.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. This is great.
If you love the Inexplicable Dumb Show as much as I do, don't be shy about it. Go ahead and wear your feelings on your sleeve, or at least your chest. Head on over to our Cafe Press store and wear your support for the IDS proudly. www.cafepress.com/dumbshow.
Alright, so I'd like to thank director Santiago Sosa for stopping by today in Studio 1103 to chat about The Winter's Tale, which is part of Nashville Shakespeare Festival's summer offering. Of course, they're also doing In Rep with The Winter's Tale, Anthony and Cleopatra. So, ticket information that we discussed about the body of the podcast, well, show run information that we discussed about the body of the podcast will be found on the show notes page for this particular episode at www.inexplicabledumbshow.com. Hey, do you want to be part of the Dumb Show? Then please do so by calling the voicemail line at 615-866-1282. Or put your thoughts in an email, podcast@inexplicabledumbshow.com. Or follow the show on Twitter, @inexplicableds, @ inexplicable, D, S. Find out the latest comings and goings and whatnot for the show via our Twitter feed. So, next week, who knows what we'll be up to, but I'm sure it'll be something good. So until next week, this is John Malden saying, hey, I'll see ya. Bye.
Are you a music lover? Then let Magnatune dazzle you with how different we are from the rest of the music industry. Interesting independent artists in diverse genres. Perfect quality wave files in addition to MP3s and many other formats. Instant album downloads or traditional CDs by mail with free shipping. All this and half of every sale goes directly to the artist. So visit us now at magnatune.com. That's MAGNATUNE. Magnitude. We are not evil.
This podcast is a member of the Blueberry Network. Blueberry. No E's. That's Blueberry, BLUBRRY.com. Blueberry.com. Pop Alternative Media.